Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, unfortunately, I don't have any comments today, so please send some if you feel like it. Even if you don't feel like it, just send some good comments. Well, every great politician, and certainly Mr. Churchill fits into that category, has advisors and confidants. Now, last week I began showing you that Winston Churchill's most trusted advisor was his wife, Clementine. So today, what I want to do is I want to continue our discussion of Clementine Churchill as Winston's closest and most trusted advisor. Now, just as I did last time, I'm using the biography titled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill by Sonia Purnell. And again, just a little caveat here is this is a new biography. It's 2015. I do feel the book is worth reading, but I'm not saying I agree with all of it. But the portions I will be discussing in today's program are what I really can agree to. So now, also, as I said in last week's program, I do promise we will get to Dunkirk, but this is an important step to it. Now, Winston and Clemmy, as she was sometimes called, got married September 12, 1908. Now, at their wedding, Dean Weldon, who was Winston's headmaster at Harrow, did make a statement in, about the wife of a statesman. And, you know, there was 1,300 guests at this wedding, and so I imagine this is probably during a toast. You know, that is a real tradition. You know, it seems like in the British world that there's a lot of toasting and people stand up and they talk about things. But here was what he said that the role of a statesman's wife should be. And it is interesting that if we look at the life of Clementine Churchill, she really did fulfill what Dean Weldon has suggested. So this is page 41. And again, what he said was, well, maybe I'll just read how she writes this. It says, Dean Weldon, who had been Winston's headmaster at Harrow, proceeded to sum up what was now expected of the bride. He says, a statesman, he declared, should be able to depend upon the love, the insight, the penetrating sympathy and devotion of his wife. Her role and the influence she would exercise in her husband's future public life was so important as to be sacred. Now, she goes on to say, Winston's vows after this portentous address were loud and clear, hers so soft as to be barely audible. The whole ceremony was a rehearsal for her future. When signing the register, Winston deserted her for an animated political discussion with Lloyd George. So I think Clementine Churchill learned very early on that there would be times, or there could seem to be at times, that Winston was more interested in politics than he was in her. But he also said at one point that as soon as he married her, his life was happy ever after. Now, we know that's not absolutely true because of all the things they had to go through, even with the death of a child. And, of course, we'll be talking about some more of these things in the next couple of programs when he really went into his wilderness years. So one of the things that Sonia Purnell brings out in the book is that politically, really, in terms of Winston's political career, that Winston and Clementine actually fought together. And she was a tough cookie. She may have been shy, but she was really intellectually astute. And after her period of education with the help of her husband, she became very politically astute. And in previous programs, we've told you that he had trouble reading people, Well, she really filled that bill for him. She could read people, and she could read what was going on with the, you know, associates he had to work with, and really did warn him many times. Now, he didn't always listen to her, but she did warn him about what was going on. Now, one of the things that if you remember back to the programs with Mr. McDonald and I, and he brought up the time of the suffragettes, and if this was the women's suffrage movement in Britain, and, you know, they became pretty violent towards him. And, you know, again, we should look at this, try and look at this not from 21st century eyes, but look at it, you know, from, well, it'd be the 19th century and 20th century, late 19th century, early 20th century. And, of course, the suffragettes wanted the, you know, the right to vote and all that. But here's one area where they didn't agree on what to do. But what I think is remarkable is Clementine kept many of her ideas about this private. And so I just want to read to you from page 57 and 58 of this book. And just to show you how great she was and how helpful she was. Now, she had her personal problems, and every human being has their personal problems. But this is page 56. It says, Winston's growing esteem for his wife's intellect did not extend to backing her calls for women to be given the right to vote. And so she wanted the women to have the right to vote. He says, to his absolute fury, his prominence made him an obvious target for the suffragettes, who regularly disrupted his speeches. On one occasion in late 1909, a suffragette lunged at him with a dog whip as he descended onto the platform at the Bristol station, lashing out at his face and pushing him toward a moving train. A small crowd watched in horror, but Clementine leaped in a flash over the piles of luggage and just in time pulled him back with all her might by his coattails. She almost certainly saved her husband's life while endangering her own. She had shown herself to be braver in real danger than all the male dignitaries cowering nearby. And yet, despite the attack, Clementine's belief in the cause of women's suffrage never faltered, and she attended several major court cases against the members' movement. Later, she looked back on those years of violence as necessary, concluding that the day would not have been won without women with a passion that exceeded constitutional and legal bounds. So you can see that they may not have agreed on women's suffrage. He did not approve the vote, pass a bill to approve the vote. But she still loved her husband so much that she leaped over a bunch of luggage to save his life. But again, she still stuck to her guns on women's suffrage. In fact, before they were married, she used to wear the dress of the women's suffrage. That was a white shirt and tie. And so I guess she wasn't so shy in so many areas. But here's another quote. This is in relation to the same issue. It says, as Clementine drew closer to him intellectually, it says, however, he softened a little. So he used to call her ideas, kind of pinko ideas. I think it was and I think it comes from pinko kami. But anyway, he called them her pinko ideas. But it says he did soften a little. When the representation of the People Bill of 1918 went through Parliament, he voted for women of property and aged over 30 to be enfranchised, albeit partly on the grounds that they might shore up his vote. In 1928, though, he abstained from a bill that succeeded in granting women the vote on the same terms as men, thereby earning himself another rebuke from Clementine for being naughty. So the thing is, she kept her views private, but she would tell him. The legacy of Winston Churchill, there are some 1,700 letters between the two of them. And so a lot of this comes out in those letters. Here's what Sonia goes on to say. Clementine was learning how to advance her views by subtle but effective means. She could not see eye to eye with Winston on the female vote, but was thrilled by his work with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, to provide labor exchanges and workers' pensions and generally improve working conditions, including the introduction of the statutory tea break. As she threw herself into politics, she developed an astute judgment of the characters involved, the goals that were achievable, and the dangers to be anticipated. Perhaps before Winston himself, she foresaw that Lloyd George's radical People's Budget of 1909, which raised taxes on cars, petrol, and land to pay for the foundations of the welfare state, would make politics very bitter. There were many in Winston's own family who refused to speak to him over his support for Lloyd George. Acquaintances would cross the road to avoid greeting a couple they viewed as class traitors because the budget sought to redistribute wealth from the rich. One summer's day, a Lady Crichton, who was shopping for china in South Audley Street, when Clementine drove by alone in a ravishing black and white striped dress. She waved gaily to Lady Crichton, who greeted her back before informing her 9-year-old daughter, "Poor Clemmy, so few people will speak to her these days." So the thing is they really did endure a lot together, but they fought together. Where they disagreed, she disagreed with him privately. And I think, obviously, people knew where she stood, on the women's suffrage movement. But again, she did not. She showed her husband the respect that he deserved. She goes on to say, in truth, Clementine saw it as heroic to be denigrated for helping the poor, and she exulted in watching Winston's popularity with the working classes soar as a result. She wrote to him, "They love and trust you absolutely." She cooed after attending a political meeting in Bingley. "I felt so proud." It was not so easy for Winston, who took great pride in his aristocratic family and was wounded by their hostility. But if he wavered, Clementine was there to stiffen his spine and act as his radical conscience. "Do not let the glamour of elegance of old associations blind you," she warned. "Real Tories are ignorant, vulgar, prejudiced. They can't bear the idea of the lower classes being independent and free." Later in her life, she was to say that these reformist years were her happiest. This was when Winston's political outlook, even if in part aimed at undermining the rise of the Labour Party, was most in tune with hers, although he did not entirely share her absolutist approach. So you can see that they worked very, very hard together. And a lot of times Winston was taken away from the family and taken away from her, but she was strong enough that that she could really stand up to the, like, being alone and having the solitude, because she was behind what he was doing. Now, I mentioned just a few minutes ago about her ability to see to perceive people. And let me just read you a quote about this. This is on page 59. She says, talking about Winston, she says, "But his life, needs, and social circle were displacing her own, and she spent much of her time with people she did not trust. These included the wily Lloyd George. Despite her admiration for his achievements and Winston's best friend, Effie Smith, she not only disapproved of Smith's Tory influence, but feared that her husband would be led away by his drinking and gambling. But Winston relished their trips away with the Hussars, including nighttime swims in a lake together, declaring, 'No cats allowed, your pug in clover, W.'" So they did have this this really private situation. He called her cat, she called him pug. And she could read people. She could read people really well. Now, in the when we get at the 1910, here's something else that she began to do. And again, remember, she was a very shy person. But when it came time for him to be reelected in the general election, she really stepped up and helped him. This is page 60. It says, in January 1910, there was a general election triggered by the House of Lords' rejection of the people's budget reforms. It was the first of 15 campaigns Winston and Clementine would fight together, and she took an active role. After all, Jenny had energetically canvassed for Winston in previous elections. He held a seat in Dundee, perhaps in small part helped by Clementine's Scottish ancestry, but overall the Liberals scraped together just two more seats than the Conservatives. The new government saw Winston promoted to become, at 35, the youngest Home Secretary since Robert Peel. He was now in charge of prisons, the police, the grisly duty of signing death warrants, the burden of deciding fate of 43 men and women who had been condemned to death by hanging was to weigh heavily on him. But Purnell goes on to say, Clementine now proved her worth. Winston would later tell his doctor, Lord Marren, how helpful it had been to talk to his wife during what he claimed were the prolonged bouts of depression, a condition that famously became known as Black Dog. He says, this is quoting him, "Alas, I have no good opinion of myself," he would confess to Clementine. "At times I think I could conquer everything, and then again I know that I am only a weak fool." And certainly his temperament was not suited to his new position, but his daughter Mary raised questions about whether his mood swings really amounted to depression. She thought, this is the daughter, his Black Dog moods are viewed by members of the Churchill family today as largely Winstonian hyperbole, and Mary thought in any case that the dog was kenneled by his love for Clementine and the confidence she now brought to him. So they went through some real tough times together, but, she became really active in promoting him, just like Jenny, his mother, had done early on. And so she was a beautiful woman. She could have influence, and she used that influence to really help her husband. Now, one of the things maybe I'll just mention this. She really did support her husband, even in very dangerous situations. Now, Brad McDonald, when we talked about the suffragettes. We also have talked about this whole situation that when he became Home Secretary, that really pushed him from the colonial, working with the colonies, to working at home. And as Mr. McDonald had said in that previous program, the people didn't care much what he was doing in the colonies, but when he began to work with things at home, that's when he really ran into a lot of trouble. And so it even talks in, Sonia Purnell even talks about how dangerous it was that Winston was willing to negotiate about Irish home rule. And she actually went on a trip with him to Ireland. She was pregnant at the time, and she said she was just going to go anyway. And essentially, the crowds were so anti, Winston Churchill, that they began to, they tried to turn the car over. They shook up the car, and actually she was buffeted around pretty badly and had a miscarriage then, about a month later. But she was still very willing to, to support her husband. And, it's really kind of interesting. Here's what Purnell said about her on page 63. It says, Clementine was aware that she was now a woman of consequence and was intent on living up to the part. Her brother Bill confessed to Winston that he held her in awe, which no one else can rival. Her social cachet grew still further in October 1911 when Winston became the first Lord of the Admiralty, in those days a position of imperial grandeur. She took up hunting, earning herself a fearless reputation in the saddle. She launched battleships with regal grace. She also demonstrated extraordinary courage in her official duties. In February 1912, the Liberal-led government, needing to reward the Irish nationalists for propping them up in the Commons, was intent on advancing the cause of home rule against fierce opposition from Unionists. Clementine became fearful for Winston's safety as he prepared for a trip to Belfast, an act deemed provocative by the Unionists. Just as Ireland teetered on the brink of civil war, although pregnant for the third time, she insisted on accompanying her husband despite warnings that she would be putting herself at considerable risk. There were police reports that huge numbers of bolts and rivets had been stolen from railway yards, and many revolvers taken out of pawn. And so again, it just shows her courage that she really did, you know, support her husband, you know, even when very few were actually supporting him, she still stood in the fray with him. And so that's a very noble quality. Now, I'm trying to give you insights into the events that we've already talked about on the radio. So I want to just spend a little bit of time related to Clementine's involvement in that battle with Antwerp, the Dardanelles, and then when he went into the trenches. Now, we may not have time now for all of that, but again, I think if these programs have piqued your interest, you might really enjoy, you know, reading the book. But when he was you know, promoted to First Lord of the Admiralty, this is where Clementine really came in to help him. And I think it's because she understood, you know, what he was dealing with. And he was being promoted. He was being promoted to really high positions in the government. And she really felt that he did not understand people, and he didn't understand the impacts he was having on people. And she really wanted to protect him. So, again, this is page 75. And it says, as First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston was charged with winning the war at sea, but as a trained soldier with battle experience, he could not help involving himself in affairs on land as well. He began to make a habit of crossing the channel to meet Sir John French, the commander-in-chief of the British Expeditionary Force, to discuss the wider military picture. Although Winston seemed oblivious to the mockery and resentment provoked by such interference, Clementine sensed the danger. She knew her husband always wanted to be at the center of any major military decision, but that others found his relish for war-making repellent. When he determined to meet Field Marshal French again at the end of September, she tactfully stepped in. And here's a quote. "Now, please don't think me tiresome, but I want you to tell the PM of your projected visit. It would be very bad manners if you do not, and he will be displeased and hurt." She also made sure her husband consulted the popular but solitary Lord Kitchener so that he would view Winston's trip as a legitimate fact-finding mission rather than a disruptive weekend escapade. She observed that in the reverse situation, Winston would be disgruntled if Kitchener visited naval commanders without paying him a similar courtesy. So you can see that she really had developed savvy, and she really worked hard to help him kind of curb his impetuousness. And there are times he listened to her, there are times he didn't. Now, with the Battle of Antwerp, if you remember, here he was, First Lord of the Admiralty. He was supposed to be, you know, worrying about the war on the sea, and yet he got himself involved in the battle at Antwerp. And, you know, she really did not think that was very wise. Notice what Purnell says here. And says, in any case, she argued, why could he not content himself with running the Admiralty? It made her grieve to see him so gloomy and dissatisfied with the high position he had reached when at 39 he was the only young and vital member of the cabinet and someone on whom the prime minister leaned more and more. The army accounted for only 1/8 of the Allied forces, and she said, whereas you rule a gigantic navy. She concluded masterfully, which will in the end decide the outcome of the war. So, you know, she was warning him, and of course we know from what Johnson tells us, he did get involved at Antwerp, and you know, she could not believe what he had done there. And here's what Purnell says about that. She says, Clementine was aghast at the danger in which her husband was placing himself, in her view, wholly unnecessarily, and concerned that the thrill of conducting his own mini-war had gone to his head. After a couple days in Antwerp, Winston telegraphed Asquith for permission to resign his cabinet position as First Lord of the Admiralty to take formal charge of British forces in the port. His lust for action met with a Homeric laugh from his colleagues. Asquith called the request a bit of tragic comedy, and he was permitted to stay only until a professional army general could relieve him on October 7th. But anyway, we all know the history that Antwerp fell a few days later. But Clementine was really astute about that, but he did not listen to her. And of course, we do know that the king of the Belgians, he did say that it actually, you know, if things had gone the way they should have gone, it was the battle that really helped win World War One. So she was very astute and very, very helpful to him. Well, I do have some things about the Dardanelles to talk about. She understood the problem of the Dardanelles, warned him about that. She really had doubts about John Fisher, which we've discussed in the past. And she knew that Fisher was, she felt, was really not right mentally. And she tried to warn Winston about that. And, of course, he did not listen to her with that issue as well. But then she was really bitter of what Asquith did at the end of the Dardanelles and how he just sacrificed Winston. She says, this is page 81. I'm going to skip ahead to the Dardanelles. You know the story. It says, Asquith knew it was his own skin or Winston's, and for him that left no choice. In the event, Winston was held liable for one of the bloodiest British military failures in history. The exact number of Allied fatalities is a matter of contention, but it is believed that Britain lost around 29,000 men, Australia 8,500, New Zealand 2,800, India 1,800, France 9,800, including deaths from sickness. Clementine would have to endure hearing Gallipoli shouted at her husband as a term of abuse for decades to come. Her instincts about Kitchener, Fisher, and Hamilton had all proved right, but she still had been unable to save her husband from his own misjudgments. But her loyalty never faltered, nor did her sense of outrage. Hearing that Asquith was about to remove Winston from the Admiralty, on May 20th she wrote in high dudgeon to the Prime Minister himself. She said, "If you throw Winston overboard, you will be committing an act of weakness." Conceding that Winston might have faults in the eyes of some, she nevertheless blasted, "He has the supreme quality which I venture to say very few of your present cabinet possesses, the power, the imagination, the deadliness to fight Germany." Now, she was also right about that, and we know that in 1917, he was absolved of all responsibility for the Dardanelles, and it really did fall on the old guard that was in charge. Well, that's all we have time for today's program. For next time, I have invited some very special guests to talk about Winston Churchill's wilderness years and his beloved estate, Chartwell. We are quickly approaching the second book in this series, also by Paul Johnson. The book is titled George Washington, Founding Father. And remember, our third book in this series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can find both books on Amazon. You can also find used copies of the books at abebooks.com. Of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. Remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.